From JetBooks, this is Irish Business Builders, a show about great Irish businesses and the people who built them. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping.
There's no point in living in a world in your head which says, you know, I wish I'd done things differently, you know, I wish I was still there, or in thinking I'd have done that differently subsequently, now I'm not there. Really, really important to move on.
I'm Conor Carney, and that's the voice of Maurice Pratt, former CEO of Quinsworth, Tesco Ireland and C&C. Maurice currently acts as chairman of Unifar Group, as well as holding numerous positions as a non-executive director and chairman of organisations across tourism, non-profit and healthcare sectors. We cover a huge amount in this conversation, including Maurice's journey from marketing manager to CEO and how he ended up on television, becoming the public face of Quinsworth and Tesco Ireland. Maurice also shares his views on managing one's time as a public company CEO and the best advice he ever received from none other than Gary Weston. My first question to Maurice was how he originally got started in marketing.
I did my Leaving Cert in 1972. I was 17 years of age. About one in five people in those days went to college. You didn't go to college. Well, I mean, it wasn't even a thought in my head to go to college. It was just you went out to work, and that's what you did. I was interested in advertising when in very early days when I was not really a lot of career guidance going on at the time. But I had this notion in my head that if I was ever to get a decent job, I'd like it to be run in Bord Fáilte, because I thought it was like selling sand to the Arabs. That was, you know, Ireland was a great place. And you know, in many respects, it's kind of interesting that I've had an interest in tourism all my life, and I've done a lot of things in tourism subsequently. So that was one piece of it. And the other was, marketing was a word that we heard about in our business organization class, but it was never well described or understood. And people, and then you'd see people's titles and it would be sales and marketing manager. And you'd ask them, well, what's the marketing bit? And they weren't clear. They couldn't really tell you. And they just thought it aided selling, which is fair enough, I suppose, conceptually. I was sort of interested, and I read books early on, like Vance Packard's The Hidden Persuaders. I mean, it's written in the 50s, but, you know, it's a bit like, what was that? Was that Mad Men series? It's sort of in that area. And what sort of intrigued me about advertising was that there was about 1,000 people in advertising in Ireland at the time, I don't know what the numbers are now, but at its peak. And I was thinking, imagine there's 1,000 people who have this massive influence on the entire population through effectively communication, but through advertising. It made people do things they wouldn't otherwise have done. Mm-hmm. So I decided anyway, when I got a good job, and but I hadn't any specific notion except I wanted to study, if I could, marketing. So discovered you could do it. There was a marketing institute course you could do in the College of Commerce and Rathmines. You could do it at daytime or nighttime. Wasn't going to do it daytime. I did that at night. I found I liked it. I understood a lot of the concepts. I mean, for me, it was really about understanding the consumer and finding ways, I suppose, to shape whatever your message was in a way that would interest them. So that's how I started. So I started with a marketing degree course, and I thought, well, it would be a good idea if I was actually in the business, if I could get into advertising. So I was doing a job where I was actually doing sort of what was called, I was just pricing jobs in the old telecommunications world, where people were fixing phones. And so I was working for a company that did that. And I saw this ad for a media planner and buyer in an advertising agency. Now, I had no idea what a media planner and buyer was, not a clue. But I put in my application for the job that I was involved in sales pricing and statistical analysis. And the buzzword was the statistical analysis, which I didn't know at the time. So, subsequently, I discovered they had about 300 applicants for the job. I was one who applied. The only reason they interviewed me was because I'd mentioned statistical analysis. So between the time they said I could go for interview, when I did the interview, I obviously ginned up a lot. And there was a guy I knew who was working in advertising at the time. So he helped me understand this whole concept of media and what it was about. So anyway, I went in, obviously did well enough to secure the job. And that was great. And ironically, so that was in the early 70s. And one of the first media campaigns I was involved with was for CNC Club Orange, which was kind of interesting in the context of what happened subsequently in my own career. But actually, I was fascinated by the whole thing. So this was the media side. So this wasn't the creative arena around, you know, well, what's the campaign message and so on? What does it look like in print and TV? This was about, you know, how are we going to get eyeballs and ears to see and hear these campaigns? So that's what got me into it, and I found that quite fascinating. And you learned about things like the TAM ratings, which were effectively how many people watched TV shows, and so I did some analysis around that, around what were the right times to buy. I mean, there was no such thing as computers to help you, but I discovered, for instance, that ads that ran at 20:57 were better than the ones that ran at 21:15, which was in the break of the news, because before people wanted to get there before the news because they didn't want to miss the head of the news, but they knew that the second part of the news wasn't as important as the first part, so they went and put the kettle on during the ad break. So those types of things, you know, and that sort of behavior of consumers always interested me. So it went on from there. I was in that agency for just over a year, and then I got a phone call from a guy, actually worked in the Irish Press, and he said, look, they're looking for a media manager in Desimar and Partners, which is an agency that had only recently started. Would you be interested? And I thought, well, yeah, why not? Mm-hmm. So I went for an interview with them, and they offered me the job as media manager. So I moved on from there. I stayed in that agency, but the agency had recently won the Quinsworth advertising account. And so I was doing the media planning on that. And then after a while, I was asked to get involved in the account handling, which is where you're dealing directly with the client. I was doing that for about, and with other clients. So, you know, I was involved with companies like Polygram or Polydor Records, as it was then. And it was great fun because, you know, you were meeting people from Demis Roussos to James Last to the Furies. And it was all fascinating and interesting.
It was interesting that you had the Club Orange account or whatever it was. But can you remember at that stage where you kind of saw your career going, you know, early on?
I wasn't clear. I mean, I was happy in what I was doing. Mm. It was a buzzy business, no doubt about it. You know, even in the late 70s, the agency had the account for the youth vote for Fianna Fáil. Mm. That was interesting. So you know, you actually got involved in a whole different sort of a whole range of different companies and businesses, and you could start to understand, you know, as I said, the motivations and the differences, and, you know, the difference between, for instance, trying to convince somebody to vote for a party versus trying to convince somebody to buy a soft drink. You know, the motivations and the psychology behind a lot of it was interesting and different. And of course, research was becoming much more prevalent then. You did, you know, back in my early days, you know, you created TV and you ran it. Now, back then, there was no such thing about, well, we put this into test beforehand and we'll see whether consumers like it, and we do three or four different versions. So it was, in that sense, it was quite early days. But to your question directly, it was really, as I got involved in the Quinsworth account, I realized that actually a business like retail was so much broader and wider in terms of its opportunity. And also it was dealing with hundreds of thousands of customers every week. It was very fast paced and it was happening, you know. So I was asked by the then marketing director of Quinsworth, in fact, the then managing director of Quinsworth, would I come and, as he put it to me at the time, would you ever move your desk from Fitzwilliam Place to Dunleary, which is where Quinsworth was headquartered, which was a nice way of saying we'd like you to work for us as a marketing manager. So that was really the point where I sort of said, well, now here's my career direction. You know, if I go with this, it's going to go in a very different direction than if I stay in advertising. And I sort of felt, even though, as I commented earlier, advertising had this great influence, that was the early 80s. And one of the first things the company asked me to do, they sent me to Canada, where we had a sister company called Loblaws, because Quinsworth was owned by Associated British Foods, which was controlled by the Weston family. At the time, they had a guy called Dave Nicol, who was the president of the company, and they were the terms they used there. You know, we use CEO here and MD. What was really fascinating was he was actually the face of the company on television. And he was promoting primarily then what they called in Canada no-name products, but what we would know in Ireland as Yellow Pack. And that, you know, the whole concept of that had come from the French, from Carrefour, who'd launched a thing called Produit Libre, which was free products. So the concept being, well, here's a good quality product, but because a fortune hasn't been spent on marketing and advertising it, we can offer it to you for less money. Concept. David Nicol was doing this on TV. He was a superstar. He was a celebrity. He was on TV, you know, on cookery programs and all sorts of different things. And I thought it was really interesting, a different way of presenting the business and company.
You know, what was it that would have made the ads better? Was there something that you kind of saw in Canada and you said, that's the answer?
No, it wasn't actually that. What struck me about it more so was, I don't know if you remember, but there was a famous comment made by a former prime minister about another prime minister in Ireland about the Taoiseach, which is, we like to know who you're sleeping with at night. The point, you know, the point behind all that was that the Irish are curious, as we are curious as a race. So we do like to know stuff about people beyond just the facade. So, you know, beyond the company, beyond the, we actually are interested in those things. You might say it's prurient, but it's just the way we are. I mean, a long, long time ago, hundreds of years ago, there was a Lord Lieutenant General who came to Ireland because it was that type of, that person was appointed by the King or the Queen in England to look after their interests in Ireland. And this particular one, after about 6 weeks, sent back a message to the King saying that he'd found the Irish to be hungry after news. And I think that's a perfect description of the Irish. We're hungry after news. And sometimes if there isn't news, well, rumour will do fine. Mm. So my sense of it was, if you could establish a direct, you know, relationship between who presented the brand and who represented the brand, then you would certainly get, you know, you get cut through with consumers. Mm. You know, I said, this is what, you know, this would be a great way to go. And they both said, yes, it would be. And we think we've got the right person to do that. And I said, well, who would that be? Because I couldn't think who they were. What are they on about here? And I said, well, no, you can do it. Who's you? I kept looking behind myself. So I thought, well, my own sense was, no, there's no way I could do that. Mm. I mean, I was quite reserved and shy, really, you know, and I was not interested in being that side of the camera. Mm-hmm. I was much more interested in being the other side of the camera and sort of directing, if you like, or positioning things. So anyway, they persuaded me that we'd do a test, and we'd make a mock commercial, and we would put it out to test to see what the reaction was. So we did that, and I thought it was absolutely awful. I mean, the notion of seeing yourself on television, you know, or, you know, in a box, even the sound of your own voice, the first time you hear it, you know, jeez, is that me? That resulted in us launching, in me launching Yellow Pack as the presenter and as the marketing manager of Quinsworth. And of course, people said, well, you know, Maurice Pratt, that's a make-up name, surely. I mean, who is this guy? but of course, the good thing was that actually I was a marketing manager and I did work in the company and this was my job. So that's how it started. And I thought, to be honest, it would be a, you know, it'd be one-off. It's a campaign. It's, you know, it's launching Yellow Pack and that's fine. So the reaction was very good initially, and you know, the thing took off in terms of sales of Yellow Pack product and so on. So the pressure was then on to, well, what's next? What do you do next? Mm. So, you know, we worked with some promotional people who had some great, I suppose we might call them gimmicks today, but we saw them as sort of promotional vehicles back then. And the next notion was, well, maybe we should give away cars, and we could give away a car a week. And then the idea was, well, maybe, Maurice, you could actually doorstep the winner and surprise them and see how that goes. A bit like with Candid Camera, I think it was called at the time. So we did that, and it was, you know, it was just very successful. It was, you know, when it just went national. I mean, today the kids would say it went viral. Mm. No such words existed like that then. As a consequence of that, now you're on a path. It's working for the company. You're part, you're now, me in this case, you're now an integral part of the brand. You know, you just, you went with the flow of it. Now, to be honest, I really didn't have an interest in having a public profile. Mm-hmm. I was concerned that it might affect my career development, because I wanted to go up the ladder, if you like, mm-hmm. get involved in strategy, become the marketing director, and you know, who knows what might happen as a consequence. So So anyway, I started to do those ads for Quinsworth and be their face about 1983. And, I was still doing it when Tesco bought the company in 1997. Mm-hmm. So that was 14 years later. So I suppose on the one hand, yes, it was successful because it did identify a brand. It did identify Quinsworth, publicly in terms of standing out versus the competition with Dunnes and so on. And, the company grew, market share grew.
Contrary to your belief, maybe at that time, that this might actually hinder your career, do you think it might have actually helped moving up the chain, given that you were so entwined now, your personal brand was so entwined with the Quinsworth brand?
I probably had mixed feelings about it at the time, but, when something's working successfully, it's hard to, it's hard to pull back. And I suppose my worry was that if I got too sucked into this, then I'm just going to get marginalized as just this person who appears on television, mm-hmm. not somebody who's actually strategically involved in the development of the company, the progress of the company. So thankfully, as I look back on it, no, it didn't hinder me. There was a steep learning curve because part of my job was visiting stores. It's kind of interesting in a way when, you can actually feel in your, you can be standing in the store and there can be people behind you, not necessarily close to you, and you can actually feel them talking about you. it's quite an unusual feeling. Now, over time, you learn to cope with all that. And actually, that's one of the good parts of it, because I would be generally an approachable person, I'm interested in talking to consumers. And of course, where better, the labs of today, where better to find out what consumers are thinking than in your own stores? Mm. Or for that matter, as I often did, walk around competitor stores and people still also talk to you and told you what was good and what was bad. So that was great. For me, there was a direct connection between, what I'm doing. Yes, I am I'm the public face of the company. And, sometimes people, I can remember one person saying to me, now, look, I'm sorry to bother you. I said, excuse me, you're helping pay my wages. This is absolutely fine. That's why I'm here. So I did enjoy that. I enjoyed the sort of interaction with people a lot. And you got good direct feedback. You knew early on whether things were working or weren't working, or if there was something wrong, then people approach you and tell you, both staff as well as customers. So it didn't hinder me in that sense. And of course, now you're on a platform. And you have to maintain that. And I suppose from the company's point of view, maybe it was a good thing that I was reserved and I wasn't really interested in being a social butterfly, etc., etc. I was interested in career development. Mm-hmm. It worked out. It certainly didn't hinder me. No, absolutely not.
So how did you become CEO of that business?
That's interesting in itself, in that I moved on, over time to the role as marketing director, which was great. So in that sense, yes, the public profile clearly helped and so on. And then in 1996, our managing director at the time, Dick Reeves, who actually had come to Quinsworth from Dunnes and who I worked with as his assistant for quite a while, and, we worked together, he announced that he was going back to Dunnes. It might not. This is a bit like Russia versus the States. It was Cold War stuff, I remember when I joined CNC, one of the boys said to me, "Who will we be at war with now?" So that'll tell you just the whole concept of competition and how one felt about it. So he leaving and going back to Dunnes was obviously a big shock. And Don Tidy, who was the chairman of the company, came to me and said, "Look, Dick has gone back to Dunnes, and I'd like you to become the managing director." So, I was delighted personally. Wasn't ready for it. I didn't feel I was ready for it. I would like to have thought maybe 4 or 5 years forward, I might have been. But as you know, if opportunities come, then you either take them or you don't. Obviously, said yes, I accepted. Fine, that happened. I then went over to see Gary Weston, who was the owners of the company in London, and Gary Weston gave me a fantastic piece of a career advice, which I've never forgotten, and I've always passed on to people subsequently when they move from a functional role into running, being the CEO. And he said to me, "Look, your expertise is in marketing. That's where you've, that's what's got you essentially to this, to the managing director's job." So he said, what I'm going to encourage you to do is to stay as far away from marketing as you can now in your new role. Get involved in human resources, industrial relations, the store operational side of the business, and all the nuts and bolts, technology as was coming in and distribution. Because they're the things you don't know as well. They're the things you're going to need to know an awful lot more about. And it was brilliant advice. Because then I could say, okay, marketing is now somebody else's issue, and you know, I'm no longer, you know, I know there was a public piece of me, but actually from behind the scenes, my job is now running the company effectively, or being MD. And it was brilliant advice. And the other thing he said at the time in giving me the advice, he said, when you're under pressure, as you will be inevitably over time, what you'll naturally gravitate back to is the area of the business you know best. He said, resist it with all your capability. Mm-hmm. And it was brilliant advice. And on a number of occasions, sort of thing, you know, I could see that happening, and I was able to, because I'd had that advice, I was able to say, to walk in the opposite direction.
And was it, you said maybe you didn't feel you were ready for the job at that stage. Was this advice sort of talking to you in the sense that you felt you didn't know the other areas of the business as well as marketing? Was that one of your
Of course. I mean, it takes a long time before you appreciate the fact that your skills will transfer, mm-hmm. you know, to whatever it happens to be. And actually, I do feel, you know, that the most important role of a chief executive is the ability to listen, process, support and coach, and, you know when is the right time to make a decision. And no, you don't have to wait till you have 100% of the facts, mm-hmm. that you can combine facts with your own intuition and make the decision. And they won't always be right. And, you know, I've made lots of mistakes. Mm-hmm. But the crucial thing is, you know, you make the decision and you learn from them. But the other piece is that you process it. You to do that well as a CEO, you need to have empathy with, you know, the people who are bringing the information to you or whatever the particular issue is. And then after that, whether it's right or whether it's wrong, you've made the decision with the best interest of the company at heart, and that's really what matters. You know, if it's wrong, it's wrong. Show me somebody who's never, you know, made a wrong decision, and you'll see somebody who's never actually taken the risks that you need to take to push a company on, you know, to grow it. So anyway, that's how I arrived as this managing director of Quinnsworth. One of the other things that I was then made aware of and became an insider in terms of knowledge of was that ABF were thinking about floating Quinnsworth and Stewart Supermarkets in the North, which was also part of the organisation, as a public company on the stock markets. So I spent the first 9 months of my term as managing director of Quinnsworth over and back to London, you know, and now you're keeping this knowledge, you know, it's private because you're working on this with a very, very tight and small team of people. And meanwhile, you're actually trying to learn the ropes of being the managing director as well in the business. So it was very exciting, actually, you know, when I think back on it, it was a really exciting time. And then that brought us into 1997. And clearly, the word must have got out, particularly in the UK, that ABF were thinking about floating the company, because Tesco made an offer for the business in, I think, late February of 1997. And we, in our plan for public flotation, we were going to announce it on St. Patrick's Day. So that was how close we were to announcing it and hoping to float in the stock market in maybe June. So obviously this was in its own way a shock, although when I look back on it now, I realise that we were being shop windowed. But that's business and that's fine. You know, if you own the business, you can make those decisions. So anyway, you know, Tesco made a bid for the business and subsequently, you know, acquired it in March of 1997, and then fully in May or June of 1997, because it was referred to Europe for a competition review and so on. So from a scenario where I thought I might become the chief executive of a public company. Mm-hmm. Now that company was being acquired by Tesco, who are a leading retailer, mm-hmm. you know, world-class retailer. So it's a very different mindset and a very different direction to the one that we were headed in.
This podcast is produced by JetBooks, an online bookkeeping service dedicated to giving you real-time financial information at the click of a button. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping.
Did you have any worries at that stage that you might be set aside, or what was Tesco's strategy in buying the company? Were they leaving most of everything in place as it already was?
Well, it's an interesting question, because Reeling in the Years has a clip of me which unfortunately continues to run, where I was interviewed on the day that of the acquisition by Tesco. And one of the things I said at the time, and I still believe it today, is that it was a very good decision for the 10,500 people that Quinsworth employed at the time, because they were being acquired by a retailer who was interested in developing retail. ABF was not a retail business. Mm-hmm. We ourselves, Primark and Quinsworth, were the only retail elements that they then had. So the previous years, they had owned retail in the UK. In that context, you were being acquired by somebody who were world-class retailers and who would develop the business and invest in retail. So it was very good, generally speaking, for the future of the company and for the people in it. It was going to provide great career opportunities and so on. Of course, I knew in the back of my mind there would be fallout. There always is when you have acquisitions and takeovers. You have no idea whether the people who come in and buy the business will want any of the current executive team. Mm-hmm. Because one of the earliest things that I realised would happen one way or another is that, you know, you'd have to build trust with new owners. Mm-hmm. And the new owners, you know, the new owners will want to do things differently. So you got to get your head around, are you prepared to participate? Do you want to stay? Do you want to be part of that change? Because there will be monumental change. Mm-hmm. Or do you want to just go and leave and do something else? I didn't make my mind up immediately in that respect. To be fair to Tesco, they asked me even before the deal was signed, would I stay? At that point in time, I'll see how it goes for the next 3 months or 6 months. But what happened subsequently then in the next couple of months was quite intuitive and insightful for me in terms of a decision, which was, so, you know, it was when it was announced, it was quite seismic in Ireland, because Tesco had been in Ireland before. And as you know, as part of Quinsworth, I had helped get them out of Ireland in terms of, you know, competition. And I felt, you know, I felt particularly good about that, as I'm sure a lot of others did as well. But, you know, so when Tesco left Ireland, and the Tesco that was now buying back into Ireland were completely different companies, different organisations, and with a different understanding. I mean, to say it in a sentence, the earlier Tesco ownership of their business in Ireland was run from London. It wasn't run from Dublin. And that was one of the key decisions I was waiting to see what would emerge. So two interesting things happened, I think, for me at the time that were very instructive. One was that there was a guy called David Reed, who was the deputy chairman of the company, and all of the international businesses that Tesco owned reported into him. And they decided that Ireland would report into him, as opposed to reporting into the UK. And that was a really important and significant decision. Because one of the things I would have said to the new owners at the time was, I know we speak the same language. I know we watch your TV. I know we're interested in your soccer teams, okay? But I said, you're looking at Ireland through binoculars, okay? We socialise differently. We think differently. We have different currency. We have different tax laws. So don't be fooled that this is just another region of, you know, this is like the west of England or northern England or wherever. It isn't. It's different. You know, it's a different country and people think differently. You know, the decision to put it into the international business to me was a very positive one and the right one. And the other was quite interesting as well, in that in the very beginning, when literally in the first few days of the takeover, I accompanied Terry Leahy, who was the chief executive of Tesco, visiting, you know, government ministers and so on. So I remember at the end of that particular day, and I was dropping him back out to the airport, he said to me, "So Morris," he said, "these people trust you, so we better trust you too," which I thought was helpful and interesting. And what led out of that was a decision that I suggested to, it was a collective decision, but I was involved in it, which was, let's give voluntary undertakings to the Irish government on how this business is going to be run as Tesco. And what that meant was, We will continue to run a head office in Ireland. We'll continue to make decisions from Ireland. Obviously, we'll take things from the UK that help the business. Mm-hmm. We'll rebrand the business as Tesco, because why wouldn't you? Because that's the company, that's the brand. The yellow pack will disappear because Tesco's its own brand. So they're all the natural things that you would do to change. And the other thing which was really important, to Ireland and to the Irish economy and food industry at the time, was we will work very hard to get Irish suppliers to supply Tesco worldwide. So we get more Irish suppliers involved in the business. There were already quite a few Irish suppliers supplying Tesco, but we will actually work hard to do that. And we will actually measure and monitor how we're doing. I think they were really important decisions, and they were fundamental to my saying, I'll stay, and I'll happily participate.
At that stage, I mean, once the business had been integrated and everything, or even throughout, you would have become the kind of face of Tesco Ireland the same way you had been previously, right?
Yeah.
You know, was that a conscious decision? Was that a strategy Tesco were carrying out in the UK? Or was it just to continue what was there before?
No, I mean, it was very clear to me that Tesco was going to run the business. The business was going to run very differently. The business would, in ways in which it could and made sense to, we would integrate. So, I sort of in my head came up with this sort of philosophy, which was, whatever it was you were talking about in the business, there were three decisions, there was a sort of a three-tier decision-making process. The first was you could take it out of the UK and just deliver it, okay? Whatever that was. The second was, if you couldn't just take it, then you need to take it, adapt it, and then deliver it. Mm-hmm. Okay. And if you couldn't do one or two, then the third thing was you created something yourself. Great example would be Tesco loyalty scheme. We didn't have a loyalty scheme. Neither did Dunnes, I mean, or anybody else at the time. Very rapidly they did. And that was the early stages of the development of loyalty. So what were you going to do with the loyalty scheme? You were going to just take it. There were little tweaks you might have to make to it, but you were going to roll it out. And that was fantastic. I mean, that would not have happened at that time had Tesco not been the owner of the business. So that was a very positive thing. The other great thing that I think at the time Tesco introduced was a whole new approach to fresh foods, chilled foods, which was a really big growing development in the UK, but we hadn't seen a lot of it in Ireland because wastage was a big issue in stores. Tesco brought that as well, and a whole range of products in that area. And then the third thing they brought, which Ireland was on the cusp of, but hadn't really got too heavily involved in, which was central distribution, which was, you know, building large facilities, warehouse facilities, and actually delivering direct to stores. And if you think about it environmentally now, say Quinsworth and Rathfarnham was probably getting 700 trucks a week delivering to a store, and now all of a sudden it's 70 trucks a week. So environmentally and every other way, that was positive. So there's some of the big things that stood out for me.
Throughout your career, I suppose, and being the face of some of the businesses, you've had family members on ads and things like that. It seems, and it certainly seems to me, from knowing some of your family members, that you've managed to split your time quite well between head of these large businesses and family time. What's your approach to that?
My approach to that is very, very simple and very straightforward. Nothing matters more than family. You know, as a CEO of the business, I would have always had a view that you need to spend time with your family, and I would always have espoused that. And how would I do that? Well, on Saturdays, I used to go around stores and I would bring the kids with me. Now, I have five sons. I didn't always bring all five, but I would. And, you know, they'd be climbing shelves and doing all sorts of things. One, I wanted them with me because they're my family and it's a Saturday. And, you know, I don't get to see them Monday to Friday at all. You know, I want to spend time with them. But secondly, it's also sending a message to the company. You know, it's a very visible business. You know, it's retail. You're out there in stores. And it sort of says you're comfortable, you know, bringing your kids with you. So, you know, why would I have a problem if I see the lady who runs the, say, the information desk in Artane, why she wouldn't have her daughter sitting up beside her on a Saturday? Mm-hmm. Why not? What's the problem? You know, I always felt that, you know, I never had a problem coming home and discussing things, you know, not necessarily confidential things, but just, well, what happened in the job today? Mm-hmm. You know, what did Dunnes do in my Quinsworth day? Or, you know, what did somebody else do subsequently? So I didn't have a problem with that, first of all. I think that's really important. Secondly, if any colleague had a domestic issue in terms of somebody unwell, their wife, their kids, I always would have said, that's where you need to be. So that was and remains my attitude to all that. So, and then the other thing, Pauline always used to complain about this, but my wife, that when we went on holidays, you know, say we're going on Easter holidays and we go to Spain for a couple of weeks, and, you know, it always used to annoy her that I get on the plane and I'd be in holiday mode immediately. Mm-hmm. So I had that ability to switch from one situation to another. I'm sure lots of people can't really do that, but I was able to do it and I'm still able to do it. And the other thing I remember, and I think it was Stephen in particular, one time we were playing golf. And I think what Stephen said to me, you know, this is great, Dad. And I don't know how old he was, probably 10 at the time. I said, what do you mean? He says, well, there's nobody hanging out here. You know, you're here with us. And it's things like that that you remember, I think, as a parent. That's really important because it's what they say to you. It's like I remember driving the kids back from St. Joey's in Sallynagan from one of their training sessions. And there was something, the Quinsworth takeover was on the radio at the time. And one of the kids in the back said, Dad, will you still have a job? You see, you don't necessarily appreciate what's going on in their heads and what they're absorbing, what they're taking in. So I think it's really important. I felt it was really important to keep them as aware as you could of what was happening and what was going on. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in a way, they've always felt, I suppose, invested one way or another, you know, in their father's career. So, you know, your question started out with, you had your kids in the ads. That was just purely a case of, well, we need a baby or we need a, you know, we need an 8-year-old or whatever we need. Well, you know, if I have them, let's involve them. Not on a known basis, by the way.
But you see a lot of business people, you know, going on holidays and they're not able to put down the phone or they're kind of jumping onto the laptop. Was it important to you to sort of set expectations with work to say that I'm going to be on holidays for the next 2 weeks and unless something's falling apart?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I suppose you could divide that up into pre-BlackBerry and post-BlackBerry, or whatever you want to call it, what it is today. Isn't it incredible? We've all forgotten about BlackBerry, and BlackBerry was probably, you know, before iPhone, BlackBerry was the go-to device. If you work closely with people, and in particular a PA, you know, PA is so important to you, I think, as a CEO, because if they understand you, and they generally do, then they know when to contact you and when not to contact you. The first thing in the morning I do is I shower. I don't even look at the phone. It is charging in the bedroom, but I don't look at it. It's upside down. Mm-hmm. It's on silent. So, you know, I think that's really important. You've got to be able to turn off. There's two sides to that problem. There is the employee thinking that they need to be on all the time when they don't. And then there's the other side of it, which is the employer not telling the employee that they don't need to be. I mean, one of the examples of that from my Quinsworth time was, and it used to really irritate me, the trainee managers who worked 70 and 80 hours a week sometimes would never go home until the manager went home, you know. So they felt they'd have to stay there, which is a load of rubbish, actually. I mean, when your job's finished, go. Mm-hmm. This thing about being on all the time is complete rubbish, in my opinion.
How important do you think was having a background in marketing for being a success when you finally got to the CEO?
Oh, I think it was really important. When I was made marketing director, and I was now in the boardroom of Quinsworth, it was Quinsworth Crazy Prices and Lifestyle at the time, I regarded myself as the conscience of the customer. So that was what was driving me. And, you know, we would have board discussions and the operational guys would want to either remove something, a service from the store or something. And I would say, well, what do you think the customers will think about that? Will they like it or will they hate it? And, you know, somebody might riposte and say, it doesn't matter. We need to cut £1 million out of costs. And I said, yeah, but, you know, there's lots of different ways of cutting £1 million out of cost. The big, most important question is, how would it impact on the customer? They are the people who we are trying to serve and do a better job for. So marketing clearly helped in that context because, you know, as a marketeer, you're thinking about the customer. Of course you're thinking about the customer. And for me, it's all about, you know, ultimately, every business should be about the customer, you know, understanding the customer, trying to anticipate what they want before they know themselves that they want it and then offering it to them. And that aspect of it won't change.
How did you end up at CNC?
I ended up at CNC because I was approached by the then CEO of CNC, Tony O'Brien, to see what I was I interested in taking up the role. And they were planning a public stock market flotation. I told you earlier what happened about the float that didn't happen in 97. And CNC was a great Irish company. as I mentioned earlier, I'd been involved before in terms of involved in planning their advertising campaigns back in the 70s. So it was kind of interesting. At one stage, my elder brother Paul had worked for CNC. So I suppose two things. I mean, I wasn't looking to leave Tesco. You know, Tesco were interested in me, you know, moving off and doing, you know, maybe running other countries, running Europe, whatever, in time. So what interested me about CNC was a few things. First of all, it was the largest Irish brand spender at the time. So it spent more money on marketing and advertising than any other Irish business. And most of, you know, even back in the early 2000s, most of the international advertising you saw on television was not created in Ireland. Whereas in the Bulmers case and in CNC's case, it was. That was one. And the second was, of course, the fact that they wanted to float the company. And I thought, wouldn't it be fantastic to run an Irish-based PLC? So they were the main, you know, they were the driving forces for me at the time. I made my decision, I told Tesco, in the first week of September 2001, okay? And a week later, 9/11 happened, which obviously caused a lot of people to think about lots of things, including me at the time. But, you know, I made my commitment, so I'm going to honour it. And then the second thing that happened before I even got into the job in January 2002 was that the Minister for Finance at the time, Charlie McCreevy, in the budget, which was then in December, and the 5th or 6th of December, announced that he was equalising the duty on cider with beer, which immediately took about €300 million off the valuation of CNC, which he subsequently admitted to me afterwards that he didn't realise would happen. He was under pressure, obviously, from the beer lobby because cider was becoming very successful. Mm-hmm. Anyway, you know, both those things happened before I joined, but, you know, that's life. That's the way the world is.
Talk to me about Bulmers and Magners, because for people in my generation, we've always seen cider as, you know, a drink that you have in the summertime when you're out kind of outside enjoying yourself in the sun. And I don't know if it was CNC, but, you know, what happened to change cider from what the original
concept was?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, and again, I would take no credit for this because it was all well in train when I arrived at CNC. And so the guys in Bulmers had decided that, you know, first of all, the great thing about cider is it's refreshing. There is no more refreshing drink, particularly, as you say, in the summertime. But the issue was it had an image problem. So it was consumed on park benches by tossers and dossers, broadly. You know, that was the reputation it had. And, you know, the company recognized that it needed to reposition the brand. That wouldn't be cheap, and it wouldn't be quick, but it was the right thing to do. So a number of things happened, you know, again, as I said, before my time. So the alcohol strength of the product was brought down from 6% down to 4.5%, which is the same as standard beer. Mm-hmm. And the brand was completely refreshed. The advertising was moved to nothing added but time. Brilliant concept. And that was followed through in all the subsequent campaigns. Very cleverly done. So the whole livery was enhanced. And it was repositioned in pricing terms. It was moved to a price position alongside, and even in some cases above, Heineken, which would have been the face-off brand in terms of beer, certainly in a bottled context. And, you know, what came out of all that was the launch of the Bulmers pint bottle. And because Guinness had this bottle, the bottle existed as a pack size. From that emerged the campaign, which was, so here, you know, here's the most refreshing way to have a Bulmers, which is a pint bottle, pint glass, half full of ice. And actually the concept was, well, there's actually more than a pint in the pint, because you pour it over ice, it's diluting, it's chilling it, it's actually bringing out the flavour of the apples. Mm-hmm. That was the concept of it. And it was a phenomenal success. Mm-hmm. As Bulmers. Beyond that, the whole marketing push behind Magners was just a replication of what Bulmers was in Ireland. And again, it was very much on trend. It was very successful. And, you know, it went very well. CNC floated in 2004. It was actually, markets were still quite difficult, but we got it away. And in the following 2 years, Magners enjoyed fantastic success. It, you know, went from being a regional brand in the UK to being a national brand. It was at the peak of its power in the summer 2006, when, you know, England was fantastic summer, best heat wave in, I don't know, 50, 60 years. England got to the semi-finals of the World Cup. it was all great. But of course, what you know inevitably will happen is that you will spawn imitators. And of course, that is what happened. And if you think about the scale and the size of the UK market, and think of Ireland. In Ireland, CNC owned its own distribution because it had CNC Wholesale. So it was actually being able to push the product as well into the pubs. In the UK, we had no distribution network at all. So we didn't own a wholesaler and we weren't a pub company. You know, we weren't a brand like Heineken or Stella, who actually, you know, had these, you know, the UK market was different then, and it still is today insofar as it had tight houses. So, you know, you could only sell certain beers if you were a tight house. What started to happen in the UK was that the other people in the market realized, A, this is a category that's worth exploring. B, there's decent margin in it because of where Magnus is priced. It's right at the top end. And C, they don't own distribution. So we could actually buy them out of the distribution that they've got in certain places. We can actually write checks to pub groups. And that's what they did. Mm-hmm. And it took quite a while, well past my time in CNC, before CNC were actually able to get into that side of the business in terms of buying a wholesaler, mm-hmm. and actually being able to control distribution into the market rather than be pushed out by others writing checks. So
is that what hampered ultimately the success of CNC?
Well, I think a few things did. That was one. So, you know, imitation is always going to happen. The question is, you know, will those imitators help you grow the market so there's more room for everybody, or will the market itself stop growing? And for quite a considerable period of time, the market did continue to grow, which was good. So it was good for CNC and good for the new arrivals in the market. What you didn't know then was that 2006 was just this perfect storm of success between the weather and just this whole thing being on trend, people being outdoors. You know, the visibility of a pint bottle outdoors. 50% of people, I don't know what it's like today, 50% of people who walked into a pub in those days did not know what they were going to order when they walked in. But if you think about it, in the summer and you're going to go out for a drink to a pub and you walk past tables full of Magners bottles, mm-hmm. what are you going to do? You're going to order a Magners. Mm-hmm. Those things, they all helped at the time. And obviously, yes, in the summer months, if you get abnormally warm weather, you're going to sell more cider. That's a fact. So what happened in 2007 and 2008 were a combination of things. First of all, the competition arriving in strength, and as I said, buying their way in some cases, and also marketing new brands in the sector, number one. Number two, CNC, we had run out of capacity to produce based on the demand that we created. And so a very significant investment was made in increasing capacity by in excess of 100%. And that was a really big investment that CNC made in 2006. So 2007 was a terrible summer. And 2008 was the start of the... Well, actually, in 2008, we were in recession. We just didn't really know it. That started in late 2007. So these three things combined to make it a much more difficult market. That's what happened. So looking back, what you didn't know was you were in a perfect world in 2006. Mm-hmm. You just didn't know that. Mm-hmm. Nothing stays the same. Everything evolves. Everything changes. I personally appreciated that it was going to be a tough ride. It was going to be difficult. The company were going to have to make significant changes to its operation. We're going to have to let people go. And that was even before the recession hit generally in terms of consumers' incomes and so on. So, you know, I recognized myself that I was the one who said, well, here are the milestones, here are the objectives we set out as a company strategically and in terms of revenue growth and so on. And they weren't achieved in 2007 and they weren't being achieved in 2008. So I was the chief executive. I'm the accountable person. That's what the chief executive, that's part of the reason chief executives get paid well. Mm-hmm. You know, some people say they get paid too well, but as one of my children said to me, so you got paid to take the bullets. And there's a certain amount of truth in that. Mm-hmm. And there's a reality in that. It wouldn't be commonly known, I don't think, but the average tenure of a FTSE 100 or 250 chief executive is 2.5 years. It doesn't sound like a long time, but it goes to show you that there is accountability and there needs to be accountability. So, you know, a consequence of all that was I resigned. You know, I did recognize, well, one, I was accountable. And number two, that when that happens in companies, the company needs to change and it's easier for people to come into the company and bring about that change more rapidly than it is for the company itself with existing management to turn it around. So that was the reality of it.
Were you disappointed at that stage? Was it, how was it on you personally having to resign?
It's tough. Yeah, it's tough because you're doing something you don't want to have to do. You wish you weren't there. But, you know, it's life. And, you know, it's ultimately these things need to be seen as being not personal. Because they aren't, and you know, that quite often I think that's the issue that arises for people, and that's why it's hard for people in that situation to get over, you know, a trauma like that, which is because they take it personally. Mm-hmm. I think it's very important not to take it personally. I mean, you made the decisions you made with the best interest of the company at heart. Whether it was because you made those decisions that you've had to resign, or whether it's because of a series of factors outside of your control, I mean, to be honest, it's a combination of both. It's not just one. Mm-hmm. There's no point in living in a world in your head which says, you know, I wish I'd done things differently. Mm-hmm. You know, I wish I was still there, or in thinking I'd have done that differently subsequently. Now I'm not there. Really, really important to move on. And just sort of say, well, you know, a bit like I remember when I was leaving, the last couple of days of my time in Tesco, my PA saying to me, you know, Morris, you're going to really be missed. And I said to the person in question, Mairead, I said, Mairead, in 6 weeks' time, you won't even remember I was here. And it's true. And because I can tell you this genuinely, in my first 6 months in CNC, I never gave Tesco a single thought. Because I was totally immersed mm-hmm. in a new role. And I think that's really important, you know, that you don't live in the past and, you know, you recognize, well, you know, you need to move on. You just need to get on and do different things.
Was there anything at that stage that helped you move on past all, you know, the CNC and having to step down?
I suppose there was, looking back on it, there was a few things. The first thing was, you know, I was 54 at the time. You know, one of the things I remember saying to myself at the time was, well, now I've had 37 years in business then, because I started work at 17. And I thought, I've had 35 fantastic years and I've had two really crap years. So I'm not going to let the two crap years spoil the enjoyment and the success of the previous 35. And the second thing was, within the first few weeks, 2-3 weeks of leaving CNC, I was approached by three different organizations to consider taking up CEO roles. And so I was confronted pretty quickly by the question of, do I want to go back into a full-time, you know, as I used to think about this as the magic roundabout, do I want to jump back onto that roundabout again? And I thought about it for a couple of weeks and I thought, actually, no, I don't. I spent pretty much all my career one way or another where somebody else ran my diary and frequently people told me what to say. And even sometimes how to say it. Wouldn't it be wonderful to be liberated to a situation where you could actually say what you might really think and have it valued because it is actually what you really think? So, and I was approached, a couple of things happened. I was also the non-exec chairman of Bank of Scotland at the time. And of course, banking was going through a crisis and they were interested in me spending some more time with them as things, you know, were unfolding. I was also approached to take on some non-exec roles. And I was approached by the Minister for Tourism who thought I had nothing to do and would I chair a midterm review of Irish tourism. So all of a sudden, very quickly, you know, I was having made a decision that I was not, you know, that I didn't want to go back into a full-time CEO role. My pint bottle was full again.
Morris Pratt, thank you very much for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you.
This podcast is produced by JetBooks, an online bookkeeping service dedicated to giving you real-time financial information at the click of a button. Our team of qualified accountants leverage the power of cloud technology to automate your manual processes and cut the cost of your finance function in half. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a 5-star review. It really helps others to find the show. I'm your host, Connor Carney. Thanks for listening.